Oscars.
Welcome to No Prize from God, Episode 12. I'm your host, Ryan J. Downing. No Prize from God features conversations with creative people about belief, unbelief, and everything between. Our guest on this episode is Sister Kate of the Sisters of the Valley, also known as the Weed Nuns. The most important thing to understand before you listen to this episode is that this conversation with Sister Kate encompasses so much more than marijuana. Yes, the Sisters of the Valley make and sell cannabis-based products, specifically with an aim towards healing. The Sisterhood launched in 2015. While they are nuns, it's not a Catholic-based organization. They draw more from the practices of the Beguine Mothers, the spiritual women of the Middle Ages who were devoted to caring for the poor and the sick. Put simply, the Sisters of the Valley have a focus on service, activism, and spirituality. They put their prayer into their work and into their activism. They take six vows: devotion, or service; two, activism, dedication of time to local politics and local causes; three, ecology, a commitment to reducing their footprint; four, chastity, privatizing sexuality, keeping themselves covered out of respect for the work that they do; five, obedience to moon cycles; and six, living simply, one bedroom, one car, one TV. Wealth goes to creating more jobs, more housing security, and more career paths for women. This might all sound complicated. It might sound wild to you, but let me tell you, Sister Kate is funny, articulate, clever, cool. As you get into this episode, a few minutes in, you may think that you understand everything they're about, and you might think, I smoke weed or I don't smoke weed, and so therefore this is relevant to me or not relevant to me. And let me just say, as someone who doesn't smoke weed, this conversation was absolutely fascinating. I'm a big fan of Sister Kate, and I have tremendous respect for what she's trying to do. I hope to pay a visit to the Sisters of the Valley at some point. Last summer, after a video went viral featuring the actress Aubrey Plaza smoking out with the Sisters of the Valley, they had a huge spike in membership requests, people trying to figure out how they could join the order, or how they could start their own chapters, or how they could build their own communities that would be similar to the Central Valley Sisterhood.
So what you've heard about our order, what do you think? Could you be this? Could you do this? Could you?
Yeah. I mean, honestly.
You'd make such a pretty, like, sister.
Yeah.
I love you.
Can I still be an actor?
Yes. Yes, oh, okay. Of course.
I want to be a weed nun.
Good. Good. We'll make you a weed nun.
Okay.
So here it is, my conversation with Sister Kate of Central Valley, California's Sisters of the Valley. This is No Prize from God. So, yeah, I'm so excited to talk to you. I've been fascinated by, I've been fascinated with what you guys do. And I should note that I am not a marijuana user myself. I'll just get that out of the way. I would imagine sometimes that's the motivation for people wanting to learn more and talk about it. I'm certainly not opposed, and I'm a full advocate of legalization. But I'm mostly just kind of interested in the overall thing. So Just to get going a little bit, I understand you are originally from Wisconsin. I grew up in Indiana myself, so I think we have that Midwestern connection.
Well, that explains why you don't use cannabis. I've been to Indiana. No, I wanted to say that I'm glad that you actually say you don't smoke cannabis, because we're not just about cannabis. Our mission, our statement, what we're doing is so much bigger than cannabis. Cannabis just happens to be the newest deregulating industry on the planet that the women have an opportunity to play in fairly, potentially. And also, cannabis happens to be hemp, which would save us from an ocean of swirling plastic if we chose to grow it and use it in place of Ziploc and non-biodegradable plastics. So it just happens that that's sort of the fuel to support us, but our mission is much bigger than just the cannabis plant. It's really a mission to create jobs and power women and to reconnect with our ancient ancestors who were basically murdered. Anybody who worshipped or associated Mother Earth with their spiritual practices was wiped out, from natives here to our ancient mothers in Europe. So we are working to reignite that consciousness.
Yes. And I find all of that fascinating and important work, for sure. And I'm curious, could you tell me a little bit, educate me on the Beguines, which I believe is a tradition that you're...
I find out that we're all saying it wrong, typical Americans. But when I first started talking to the women about the Beguines, I said, I think we're saying it wrong. Recently, we had a hot shot British documentary team come over here. And of course they went off and researched it, and the proper way to say it is Beguines. So we're learning to say it properly. It's Beguines. If you spelt it, you would think you're saying Beguines. So I think we should be acceptable to both.
Forgiven for our Americanization a little bit.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. It's okay. I think we need to be okay. But essentially it's like this. In the Middle Ages, starting as early as the 600s that we have evidence, so it probably goes back earlier than that, and our claim is that, yes, it goes back to forever. That forever, since the beginning of time, when society and laws and government failed the people, the women would band and find solutions. That's our premise. So in the early, starting in the 600s, there were these enclaves of women who dressed alike, lived together, worked together, prayed together. They farmed and they had apartments inside the castle. So they didn't exclude themselves like many monastic communities do. They were about serving the people. These were our Beguine foremothers. These were the foremothers to the Catholic nun. I believe personally that the whole Catholic nun order came out of the Inquisition and killing women who were smart and spiritually independent. Therefore, the only way they could survive, that essentially the birth of the Catholic nun order was a survival move for smart, independent women. And so what we are doing is we are saying, come on, let's get real and look back at history. The slaughter of all practices that bring Mother Earth into the formula, the elimination, the systematic elimination of that, has contributed to us fracking and plasticking and trashing our planet. And we can't anymore. We have to take a turn. So our spiritual practices are reflecting that turn. And we didn't create this. This is going on all over. We just plugged into what's a current, basically.
Mm. And you're every bit as articulate and welcoming about all of this as I had anticipated. So I'm already having fun. I gotta introduce you. I'll shoot you an email with some links to it. But I the most recent guest that I just interviewed, a wonderful woman by the name of Karen Crisis, who has just she spent a bunch of time in Italy. Researching the tradition of witches there, and wrote a whole book about it. And she is a practicing witch herself. And I think there's a lot of commonalities and crossovers in some of the things that you're talking about, particularly in the history side. I've always found it interesting from a theological standpoint, you know, when you get this outright dismissal of a Mother Earth concept, when it's like, well, but the whole Abrahamic monotheistic God, that's sort of the, you know, the baseline conversation God that people in the West are talking about, the concept, that's a Father Sky. So it's like, well, how do you think these concepts even developed? You know, it's like, of course there was a Mother Earth and there was a Father Sky. It doesn't make any, a lot of sense otherwise, especially when you're talking about creation and, you know, children of God, so to speak. So, and it gets into, you know, it's funny, all the conversation in our culture right now about gender identity. And when you really get into some of the language, even with Christianity and with a lot of spiritual practices and traditions, you know, it was a patriarchal society that was codifying and, you know, doing the canonization of all of this stuff in these masculine terms. But when you get back to some of these ancient languages and traditions, it was a lot of gender non-specific language that just so happens we've all learned it the specific way.
Exactly. And what's happened, what I call, and it's no offense to any of the men of Indiana or men anywhere, but I call it white man culture, because I went and spent time with the natives, and white man culture and Christianity and the disrespect for women all goes together. I mean, one of the things I was told before I went on this sacred mountain trip with one of the elders of the Yaqui tribe was, I will notice while I'm up there that if two or more women are gathered on the path and talking, and people come to walk down that path, they will go off the path and way around to not disturb the energies or focus of the women, because if the women are talking, it is highly likely that they are healing, and therefore they're doing God's work. And it's such an opposite approach to sort of the Judeo-Christian upbringing where the men will interrupt the women because the women have nothing important to add or say. So, and I was raised in that environment where men would walk in the room in a very Catholic family, where if the women were talking, men would walk in and talk right over us. And that was okay. Women could never do that to men. So yes, I think there's a strong tie between Christianity and sort of the shitting on women and the shitting on the planet. It all kind of goes together. And I'm sure you've heard this before. I didn't create it. What I set out to do was to unite women from, you know, around the world into something that's big and beautiful and has a little bit more political power so that we can help, you know, take over the world.
You know, something that came to mind, and I think it's because I literally just saw it last night, but one of my favorite shows is Peaky Blinders, which is a BBC drama, and it's set during kind of post-World War One in England. And in an episode that I just watched last night, there was a scene where two women walked into a pub, and they were reminded by the barkeep that unaccompanied women weren't allowed in bars. Right. And it's, you know, and to hear that, you know, juxtaposed with, you know, the picture you just painted of two women talking on the trail and the energy that creates, it really does
right.
say
it's
a lot.
It's an opposite thing. And we have to reconnect the divine feminine to the planet and to our spirituality in order to get into this next stage that the planet's headed towards anyway. All that Trump is, and all this noise is, and this robbery by the 1%, and this victimization of the poor, that's the last dying gasp of a paradigm that's on its way out. And so, of course, they're kicking and fighting, and they're not going to let go easily, but they're on their way out. So we're entering a new paradigm. We're entering, you know, a 200,000-year period of the divine feminine ruling the planet. And we have to be all about our nesting energies. And I think that the men, many of whom, you know, I actually think that the broken family and the high divorce rate was for a reason. It was to give us sons sympathetic to the single mother, because our new generations, our millennials, and even the men in their 40s,
a good percentage of them have been raised by single mothers, and they're very sensitive. They end up being very sensitive to the needs of the women.
I'm a man in my 40s who was raised by a single mother. Ding,
there
ding, ding.
There you go. There you go.
Yeah, very insightful. I had a dad who disappeared for a long time.
We're on a planetary trajectory towards the divine feminine ruling, towards the women having more say and more, towards tilting the balance back now. We've suffered. We've been persecuted. In one of my recent readings at a moon ceremony, I was explaining how systematically for 300 years in every culture, women, smart women and their men and their children were accused of witchcraft. 15% of the population over 300 years. So I said, what happens when you systematically wipe out the smartest and brightest of your women is you end up with Harvey Weinstein and Kim Kardashian. Yeah. And I believe that. So now we have to atone for that. And part of how we feel atoning for that is reconnecting to the beliefs and the belief systems and the practices that were brutally stamped out.
You mentioned Harvey Weinstein and also talking about the election. And I'm reminded of two things that I've been thinking. This was something, you know, I mean, I can be cynical at times, but my glass half full explanation that I was sort of providing to friends and loved ones around the time of the election was, you know, we've had so many steps forward of progressive and positive change, but particularly with social issues, that it only made sense that there would be this, exactly as you described it, I was describing it in the same terms, sort of this last gasp of the previously dominant culture,
yes,
kind of kicking and screaming and clawing,
yes,
to hold on. And that to me, is the explanation really for what we're looking at. It's not that nothing's changed. It's that everything's changed and that's what's, you know.
And it is ugly and it is horrible, but in order to keep from being depressed, I look at it like we got a front row seat at the best show on the planet in the last like 500 years. I mean, it doesn't get any better than this. We're watching old might is right paradigm die, and we're watching it implode. We're watching the women rise up and the divine feminine rise up. Women who could, like 20 years ago, it would be unheard of a 60-year-old woman to come out about a sexual assault that happened 40 years ago because everybody would just assume she lied. Guess what? No one assumes that anymore. They're listening to the women. The planet is listening to the women. Men are dropping like fleas for being leeches. I'm sorry, Al Franken should not have had to resign. He is not a sexual predator. But men are dropping, that our sexual predators are dropping off of TV programs, and the women are running them, the news programs, and their opinion polls are going up. That's never happened before in history. History has been really mean, and the public, we ourselves, have been mean to women. We are actually calling ourselves on that kind of stuff in our own sisterhood, where culturally we don't have the tools or the words to respect women leadership like we do men. And so now we have to find that again. It's not gone. It's just dormant.
Rose McGowan has said she'll do the podcast. It's just a matter of scheduling. And this is even just reminding me of how, I've got to turn her on to what you're doing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I feel like what's happening, you know, with the Harvey Weinsteins, and that, I mean, a lot of it is the light switch has been flipped on, and we're seeing all the roaches and they're scattering. And I think that's also, that explains, you know, the march in Charlottesville and that sort of thing too. I feel like, to put it in religious terms, what's happening in terms of the sexual harassment and sexual assault and so forth that we're seeing, it's a reckoning. I feel like a reckoning is occurring where, you know, some long overdue punishment of sorts is coming out. And, you know, a friend of mine, Anna Marie Cox, wrote this column for the Washington Post that was published this morning that was actually about Al Franken and whether or not he should resign. She's one of his constituents, in addition to being a, you know, pundit and culture commentator. And one of the things she pointed out I'm paraphrasing, but she pointed out that, you know, these aren't death sentences that are being doled out to these men. You know, the idea of losing your $25 million a year TV job or not being able to produce films, or even in Senator Franken's case of resigning, you know, we're not putting, you know, this complaint that you hear of, well, everyone's being tried and convicted in the court of public opinion without due process. It's like, no one's, you know, they're not being sent to jail, let alone, you know, put out to the streets to starve.
I know.
You know? So I think, I think there is something to be said there.
I want the women to be better than the men at this. That's all. And I don't want to be, I don't want to be hanging men. First of all, you cannot have men and women work together in a passionate, high moving environment and not expect some sexual things to happen. That is ludicrous. So we have to educate the world. If we're going to switch the light on, let's switch all the lights on. And let's do a little bit of just logic here about men and women and chemistry and working together for the same mission and what can really happen when grown-ups are together, which is one thing. And sexual predators who say, you either get on your knees and do this or I'm going to ruin your career. Those are very, very, very different things. And if we're going to hold the men to a standard that we, the women, cannot stand to, like, I'm sorry, I've told some very tasteless jokes in my life. And I've even played some drunken dart games that were like with obscene posters. So, I mean, we just have to be really, really careful here that we don't stop or try to resist what's natural. And chemistry between men and women working on campaigns or putting on a play or whatever, when you get them together and you get them on a mission, chemistry is going to happen. Kisses are going to happen. More than kisses are going to happen. Flirting is going to happen. That is not the same as sexual predator.
Yeah, there's so much nuance, and nuance is often a thing that, of course, gets lost in hyperbolic conversations about hot button issues. You know, there's,
well, it just makes me sad because we have very few champions of the people in the White House, and Al Franken is one of them, a champion of justice. So we've already got a casualty to the war. And again, I get what Anne Marie Cox is saying, that our ancestors suffered much worse. Our ancestors, our female ancestors, were burned at the stake for anything inappropriate. So I get it, but I just want to be better. And we don't want to do, in the correction of this course, we want, don't want to have collateral damage.
And a point that she made was that, you know, Al Franken could go away and reflect and become even, she was suggesting that he could become even an advocate and a voice for this whole Me Too movement. And she said, you know, if he resigns and makes some changes and becomes a greater ally than even before, and he were to run again, I would vote for him. And kind of what she was saying was, this idea that everyone needs to go away, or that we're leveling the field, Roy Moore is the same as, you know, Al Franken. And this, you know, the singer Morrissey is in hot water, and some of his fans are even publicly disavowing him. He was quoted as something that was construed as a defense of Kevin Spacey and Harvey Weinstein. My personal take is that wasn't my read on the quotes. It was maybe clumsily worded. But what he was saying was, you know, he was talking about the danger of people who are just bad at flirting or bad at, not by any means say that's Kevin Spacey, right? But awkward courtships.
They're a little autistic. They don't read the social clues. They don't get it. They're clumsy. Yes, that's funny. That is kind of funny, but there is some kind of truth to this. This is not an uncomplicated or unnuanced issue, but there are some things that are very simple. Harvey Weinstein, very simple. You're messing with women's careers in place of sexual favors. Mm-hmm. That's all. Not very nuanced to me. That's very simple. You're in power. You're requiring something of someone that they wouldn't ordinarily do. And that is immoral, illegal, and unethical. That's all pretty simple stuff. It gets complicated when you know, somebody grabs, you know, your bottom, and then they think you wanted it and you didn't want it. And, you know, I think one of the things that's going to lead us out of this darkness and this confusion and make it not complicated is our millennials. Because our millennials really don't take up with any shit from anyone. And I love them for that. The girls are, we were just saying at dinner the other night that in 5 years, those girls are going to be looking at women at our age and asking us why we ever covered anything up. Like, what's wrong with you? They're not going to be able to relate to the sort of energy of I can't call him on this because he's in power. I don't think our young girls will be able to relate to that concept at all. And that's a wonderful thing.
Indeed. And you brought up a very great point a little while ago also about, you know, the way that some women have been browbeaten by this culture to even sort of turn on other women, where I have a close friend who's, you know, close female friend who's, you know, she has a law degree. She runs a spectacular yoga practice. She's very progressive. And she said to me, you know, I mentioned to her that Rose McGowan was going to be coming on the podcast and how excited I am by that. And she said, well, you know, I think it's very convenient that Rose McGowan's become so outspoken because she took money from Harvey Weinstein and was happy to be quiet and let, you know, countless more women be assaulted by him. And I just, you know, that purity and that sort of eating of our own that happens, that's something that's got to go away too. You know, never mind the fact that somebody like Rose McGowan was, what, she was 22 years old and getting bad advice from lawyers and also was in a culture and a situation even different than right now, where her advisors were telling her nothing's ever going to happen. He's not going to get arrested or lose his job or,
right.
You know. So,
right.
Yeah, it's complicated, like you said. And I think the more that this stuff...
But we're very conscious of that. I'm very conscious of it. I'm very conscious of the fact that two things happen as we grow a business and as my hat as the chief of the business, when I'm wearing that hat, my staff holds me to a higher standard in how I speak to them than they would hold a man. And they expect me to be motherly sweet all the time, but if I was a man, they would not expect that. And I call them on that all the time. Like the difference in standards between a woman and a man, and also the what you just said, women, we have to learn to have each other's backs again. We have to learn to respect each other, revere each other, hold each other up, and not have not this criticism. I was so angry at a group of women that attacked Mother Teresa for not doing enough. I'm like, okay, you guys are all over the line, because who are we to say what her giving and compassionate walk should look like? We all come to this earth plane and we get to choose the flavor and the style and the smell and the location of our walk. We get to choose all that. And so Mother Teresa chose to give her life to the sick in her way. And there were women who tore her down who felt like she didn't use her influence or her power in the right way. Yeah, that goes in the category of, you know, those people will never be satisfied with what you put before them. And you have to turn off that noise and continue on your walk.
Yeah, I Bill Maher said once on his program, the idea that liberals and progressives are so concerned with making sure one little corner of the house is spotless while they'll let, you know, dog shit be piled everywhere around them. And that does, you know, yeah, the puritanical sort of witch hunt, if you'll pardon the bad pun for this conversation.
Right, right. Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. That's what it is. It's like to look for any weak, the whole cause is bad because they can find one little weakness somewhere. And that's ridiculous. And I don't want to work with those people. Who would want to work with those people?
Yeah.
So it's like, get out of my way and bring in the people, the troops that have vision, that have purpose, and realize that everything isn't a perfect walk.
And when you said the thing about, you know, being held to a different standard as a woman, as a boss, as a leader of a business and an organization, and then you take that and extrapolate it into the creative arts when you start dealing with musicians and film directors, and
right.
Then it's like, well, he's a genius. So, you know, you just gotta kind of put up with the tantrum or the abusiveness or the, and I think what we're seeing as part of this reckoning right now is people are going, no, I think we can find geniuses who aren't also assholes. Like that can be a thing. and how many, and how many talented people did we never get to, you know, recognize or see their work
or meet
supported or explored, right? Because they were edged out of the conversation by some, you know, tortured artist who was kind of just a jerk.
Right.
So I'm really, I want to get into, you know, I've seen you describe yourself and the sisters as anarchists. And I'm curious, I think there's a lot of baggage, much like, you know, witch, feminist,
yes.
Liberal, yes. Like a lot of words. I think there's baggage that comes with that. Could you explain for our listeners a little bit about that?
So we're kind of unlikely anarchists in that we believe in paying taxes, a lot of taxes. We believe in overpaying our taxes because Americans, our attitude is that Americans are acting like a conquered people towards their government. If the goal is to starve the government of tax money, then you are not working with your government. You are working against your government. So, and we feel that the problems with agricultural places that are starved for enlightenment is also because they are starved of tax monies. And so we pay federal taxes, state, two types of state tax, payroll tax, every possible tax that can be paid, plus we pay, and we pay willingly and happily. And we feel that as good business women, we have to engineer for that and account for that. And we try to pay almost all our taxes real time, so there's never a tax debt. So that doesn't sound like anarchist to anybody, I don't think. But where we are anarchists is we are coming January 1st, we are operating a cannabis business for 3 years without local permission, without local licensing, without state licensing. So in that way, we are anarchists. But in that way, we are also inviting all of the women of the world to be anarchists with us, because all of the plants that we grow and the medicine we make won't get anyone high. It's essentially hemp that looks like cannabis, where you let the colas grow and the greenery grow. And it won't get anyone high.
It's more about the CBT than the THC, is that right?
Yes, it happens to cure seizures and cancer and all kinds of things, according to other people. I'm not making this claim, FDA, if you're listening, we make no claims. But it happens to, people say it cures their cancer. So it's kind of an important plant. It's kind of an intelligent plant and an important plant. And so we tell women everywhere to start growing it outside, inside, everywhere. Here, a couple of things will happen. If they do that, if people try to steal their plants, they won't get high. So they won't steal them twice. So we would fix the poverty problem, right? Because thieves don't want to go cure cancer. And if they do, wouldn't that be wonderful? So I call on all the women of the world to grow these strains that are healing strains and won't get anybody high, because I don't think the laws were meant for this. The laws were meant for the stuff that gets you high. We're not playing with, selling, or working with the stuff that gets you high. So we've sort of taken an anarchist position that those laws don't apply to us.
I love it. Particularly if the goods and services that you're producing are intended for healing. You know, I mean, what
yes,
could be
they
more?
Are. Yes,
you know.
They are.
That's where it's the spirit of the law versus the letter of the law, right?
Right, exactly. And nothing we sell or make do you smoke. So we have no smokable products. It's all tinctures and topical salves that 50% of our sales is our topical salves that we refer to as sort of the Burt's Beeswax of the CBD industry, because we never expected that to be so popular, and we never expected that people would use it to replace their sleeping pills. I mean, who would think that you'd rub a topical salve on your temples to go to sleep at night and not take a sleeping pill? I wouldn't have thought of that. So when we put it out there, we did invite the public to help us investigate into what that topical salve would fix or would alleviate pain for. And we found out all kinds of things, diaper rash, earache, toothache, and especially the migraine prevention. We were going for muscle and joint pain and fibromyalgia, which we have tremendous number of hundreds of testimonials on that. But we were surprised at the number of people who told us that they put it behind their ears every morning to prevent migraines, or they rub it on their forehead at night to go to sleep. And so it's very, very interesting. We're very, very lucky women to be playing with in such a sort of magical new world.
Now, I would love to get into with you a little bit more about the Beguines, and I guess the yes. Beguards and the yes. know, these religious orders that were I think it was Northern Europe, right? The quote unquote Low Countries. I would be not so much. Well, I mean, we can get into the historical side of it as much as you would like to, but I'm more curious about the traditions and the you know, whether it's the rituals or the dress or the adopting of names, like, you know, Sister Kate. Where that stuff sort of comes from, you know, how you're discovering it, how you're applying it to what you're doing now, and that okay. sort of thing.
Okay, so when I started this, or when this was an idea, like this order was born of the Occupy movement and my sister Occupy antics, and between 2011 and 2015, there was much discussion on what this would look like if I was lucky enough to found something, what it would look like. And so the idea is that the Beguines did not take any vows, but the Catholic nuns that came around in the 880s, they did take vows. Now, it's not surprising that the same time that you had the first Catholic order, you have the Gutenberg press being invented, so the first publishing of printed word. And Gutenberg was an avid Catholic, so the first book ever published, and for 100 years the only book, was the Bible. So you have a Franciscan monk, Saint Dominic, founded the first order of monks on a hillside, and he came from wealth. So he just bought a castle on a mountaintop. His sister, Scholastica, wanted to come with him and devote her life to Christianity, and he said, no, this is only for men. So she bought her own mountaintop, and essentially that was, to me, That period of time, if you look at the Inquisition and what was going on, if you wanted to be a holy woman and you wanted to be left alone to study and ponder life, that was the only choice. So the invention, Scholastica invented something that would fit the Christian church that would allow her to stay alive. And that required chastity. That required celibacy. But before that, we had our Beguine mothers who were more about women empowerment. They dressed alike, they lived together, worked together, and prayed together, just like a Catholic nun eventually did. But they were about empowering the women. The women had their own quarters. The poor women housed together, but the wealthier women had their own houses, and they put their houses in circles for protection, but they believed in private property and private space and private choice and in wealth and in the women owning the businesses. That all stripped away with the Inquisition and the oncoming of the Catholic religion. So we're reaching back to when were women empowered. So where we are like them is that we are like the Catholic nuns in that we do take vows. We chose to take vows, but we don't take vows to an order. We take a vow of ecology and a vow of activism and a vow of chastity, which the vow of chastity has to do with dressing conservatively as a meditative practice of being in touch with our ancient mothers and to keeping in mind every moment of every day that we want our ancient mothers to be proud of the work we do. So we have all this symbolism between our vows, but what I'm saying is that our Beguine mothers didn't take vows. They had men there sometimes. They could leave and get married and live with a man for a decade and come back, and they weren't empowered. They weren't stopped from doing that. It's the same with our vows. Our vows are not to me or to the order or to the sisters. Our vows are lifetime commitments to ecology and activism and organizing our lives by moon cycles. So there's no deity in there.
Mm. Yeah. I like the idea that, you know, going back to something that could be dedicated to living together communally and, you know, observing these different ideas and shared practices, but yeah, not being committed or vowed to the hierarchical structure of an organization like a church, that's more
right,
more sort of localized. So what are some of the, is there a, you know, without a deity at the center of it, certainly in terms of the Western Judeo-Christian understanding of a deity, certainly it sounds to me like there is a spiritual component to the community that you've built.
There's a strong spiritual component. We do the blessing of the hands, the blessing of the tools, the blessing of the packages, but we're more likely to meditate than pray, because everything we do and everything we structure is through the question is, what is more empowering to the women? Meditation is more empowering than prayer. Prayer is like being a child and begging. Meditation is manifesting the powers you were born with. So we have a lot of both going on, actually, because I was sort of raised very strict Catholic and by nuns I adored. It's easier for me to pray than to meditate. But the young girls, it's easier for them to meditate than to pray. It is very fun for us because we have this, for the first time in probably 1600 years, we have a generation or two of children who are not indoctrinated with any dogma. So to ask them to get in touch with what feels good and to go do research on YouTube and find us a chant and do this and do that, they're very open-minded. They're not as suppressed. The young girls are particularly starved to actually have this because they've never had it. They've never had any of it, from the candle lights to the chanting and the scents, and they love it. So that's very fun. But as far as, yes, what we did is we looked at, there's two things that we look at to make our spiritual practices and our beliefs. My ancestors by blood, who are they, where'd they come from? That's where the beguines come in. And the ancestors of the land that we are on, which happens to be Mano, was the area the natives called it, but it has, you know, all different tribes, Yaqui and Ojibwa, all different tribes met here in the Central Valley. So what we did is we looked at the top like 12 beliefs of our Beguine ancestors and the top 12 beliefs of the Native Americans of this land. And where those beliefs overlapped in 8 places, we said those are our 8 core beliefs.
Wow.
And those start with things like, both cultures practice rites to attune themselves with the natural rhythms of life forces marked by the phases of the moon and the seasonal quarters and cross quarters. That's us organizing our lives by moon cycle. Both of those cultures recognize that our human intelligence gives us a unique responsibility toward our environment. Mm. And both of those cultures seek to live in harmony with nature. So that's number 2. Number 3, and I'm only going to do 3 because I don't want to bore you with this, but
I'm far from bored, by the way. I'm eating proverbial popcorn was listening to this. I'm right up my alley. So yeah, continue.
Okay, so, and then number 3 is we demoted Creator God to number 3. And we did this on purpose because we think people will walk over the sick and dying to get to church in time. And that is not the point of any religion. So 3 is that both cultures acknowledge a depth of power far greater than that apparent to the average person, a creator, and a connectedness between the people themselves and with the planet. The indigenous tribes call that the Great Spirit or Godfather. And so that is God. That is our belief in God and a creator God. But to us, that had to go to third place behind the planet and her people and the organizing our lives by moon cycles, because all of that connects the planet to the people. So those are 1 and 2, like Earth and God is number 3, creator God in our practices.
I didn't lose you, did I?
Are you there?
Oh, there you are. Yeah.
No, sorry. Are you there?
Yeah.
I just took a break in case you wanted to interrupt our asking.
Okay. I was afraid. No, I don't. I certainly don't want to interrupt at all. I could. If you ever give lectures, I could attend one and sit in quiet contemplation and listen.
Okay. Well, I'll go. Do you want me to quickly skip through 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 then?
I would actually love to hear what they are. Yeah.
Okay, so number 4 is that both cultures recognize both a spiritual world and a physical world, and that the interaction of these two worlds is the basis for paranormal phenomena and magical exercises. And so that's our fourth belief. The fifth is that both seek to control the forces within themselves that make life possible in order to live wisely and without harm to others and in harmony with nature. So that's sort of our self-improvement clause. And both cultures practiced that and believed in that. And both so number six, both cultures are concerned always with the past, the present, and the future. And we try to practice that. Every moon ceremony begins with calling on our ancestors and ends with talking about preservation of the future for the generations to come. Number seven, both cultures eschew, I don't know any other way to say this, eschew or reject those who seek power through the suffering of others. And neither of the cultures believe in a Satan. And then the final one is that both cultures believe treating people and their spiritual beliefs with respect. But we have a caveat there. The only animosity held by both of these cultures towards Christianity or towards any other religion or philosophy of life is to the extent that those institutions have claimed to be the one and only way. So our caveat is that we have to respect all religions, but we don't have to respect religions that claim to be the one and only way to spirituality.
Yeah, I think it's that would fall into the category of we have to respect all beliefs, but we still have to reject white supremacy. And, you know.
Yeah.
I'm with you.
And that's ancient wisdom. That's ancient wisdom. That's our eight commandments, you know.
So I'm interested probably more from a personal perspective, I suppose. Where do animals enter into this with the ecological slant and the emphasis on justice and equality and fairness and all of that? Is there an animal liberation component?
Yeah, so I always tell people that I'm not really a farmer. I'm only here for the weed. and there's some total heavy truth to that because I'm not a farmer. I'm a city girl. I'm a business analyst. I've lived and worked in big cities all my life, but I'm on this farm because of the beliefs of this order and what we're trying to do. So the women, we're all kind of wannabe vegans and we're really bad at it. And I was just saying this morning that I can do without the meat, but I can't do without the cheese or the cream in my coffee. So we try. We're trying to go more plant-based in our diet. We're trying to go more reducing our footprint. That's part of our consciousness, part of our weekly meetings. But we are also very on the grid kind of people. So we consume so much Wi-Fi here on this 1 acre farm. You wouldn't believe it. We're over consumers of Wi-Fi and we're trying to be under consumers of plastic and meat. But, you know, I would say we're not, we've got a long way to go yet, but it's a journey and we're trying to do it in a way that we don't give anybody a bad attitude, that they want to stay on the journey and stay on the path.
Yes. Which it seems like is also a paramount thing in the overall practice that you've created, even by, you know, putting God at number three, as you mentioned, I think is probably bringing some folks closer to the concept of a God by even getting them in the door where they may have not have stepped inside if God was number one.
Exactly. We're trying to bring back into the fold a lot of people that are missing spirituality, but can't align themselves with certain things, practices that have gone on. And we understand this is, we consider ourselves spiritually to be a work in process.
Well, as everyone should, and the scariest thing, and I say this on the podcast all the time, I've learned is certainty. That's the, I feel like certainty is the ultimate sin when it comes to theology and spirituality and any of these concepts. I mean, certainly I do think there are values and truths and fundamentals that one could and should cling to. But beyond that, when it gets into the nuances of belief, you know, it wouldn't be belief if we were absolutely certain of it. And it should always be evolving. I can tell you, as someone who first became vegan in Indiana in 1990, you have a way easier time now in this day and age in California. So, yeah, now you can go into Starbucks and order almond milk in your coffee. Whereas, you know, in 1990 in Indiana, there was one health food store in the entire city. It was, you know, in an old house with a slanted floor. It is another sign of optimism that people are going more and more plant-based. And of course, as clearly you already know and understand, and I'm happy to hear by the way, I was going to back off the topic if you didn't want to go down that road, but certainly how much animal agriculture influences climate change and resources.
I don't want to avoid that subject at all. I just want to say that personally, I've always been very vegetarian. I mean, when I raised my children and my husband, we never had like red meat more than once or twice a month and any meat more than once to 1.5 times a week. So we weren't your typical people who had gotten to eating meat for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, or white processed flour, cheese, and meat for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I've always been more that way. I've just never been able to be very purist about it. And depending on the sisters that come and go and who's cooking and who's not, we go with the flow. Right now, we are trying very hard to be more strict about vegetarianism. And we're trying to get better about more hardcore about our recycle practices and what we can do with some of the plastic that we can do from a plastic crushing machine that we just got. So there's some like build our own chapel out of plastic. We're trying to do some kind of creative scholarly projects through recycling.
Incredible.
And we're also building a yurt. We're also raising money. So www.gofundme.com/weednun. And if you give a $25 donation, you get a calendar from us, Sisters of the Valley calendar, which you can't get anywhere else. and we're building a yurt for an ex-Catholic nun to come join us. So we've got an ex-Catholic nun in North Carolina who wants to come join us. We just didn't have the housing for her. So we're raising the money to build a yurt to put her in.
Nice. Very nice. Well, Sister Kate, I could talk to you all day. I love everything I'm hearing. I think there's got to be something in there of being raised in the Midwest. I also came from my family's Irish Catholic on my dad's side and Irish and Scottish and Presbyterian on my mom's side. And I have that same sort of almost superstitious attachment to some of that Catholic framework, while at the same time always being very iconoclastic and bucking against all the stuff that got attached to it that's clearly wrong. You know, so
yes, but our moon ceremonies, like every the way we're organized is our spiritual like gatherings, our new moons are for the women and full moons are for the tribe. So every full moon we have a feast, and we might have the smallest feast now is like 30 people, and the largest we've had have been like 50 to 60 people.
Wow.
But we have a dinner. And then we have a fire circle set up outside with rings of benches and chairs around the fire circle. If it's too cold or bad, we will go into the abbey. And we don't like it in there because we have to organize it church style, where people are in rows of chairs looking at us, and we prefer the fire circle. But our ceremonies are very laid out. Almost, they have a very Catholic feel to them. We have particular readings we do that are Mother Earth readings, that we do the same reading over and over. And the people say, help us heal the people and our planet, Mother Goddess. And that's their response. So it's the crowd responds. We have certain prayers and things we do that are all about Mother Earth and the coming people. We use the almanac. But it's very ceremonial. There's incense. There's bells ringing between each segment. There's fire circles and fire dances. But it's very organized. And that is very much the Catholic influence, because there are those ceremonies, those repeat words, those chants, those songs. It's soothing. And our group keeps growing and people keep coming from further and further because they find healing in the ceremony itself. And that is what I miss from Catholicism. And I think that's what a lot of people miss from their spirituality.
Well, I think this brings our conversation full circle as well, where you know, it's all about balance. And I think in sort of rightly rejecting a lot of the historical injustices and bad theology of bigger organized religion, you know, sometimes people are throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And the idea that we need to do away with all forms of magic and mystery and divinity and that part of the human experience that I think is no less essential than it's ever been, you know, I think is doing a real disservice to, like you said, people that, you know, there's people who haven't been raised with any of it who are showing up going, wow, I didn't realize that I needed this. So long as it's in a, you know, a non-destructive, safe and welcoming environment, as all of those traditions once were, and were perverted
right.
along the way.
Exactly. Exactly. And so we're really all just trying to reach back to sort of our pre-Christian ancestors that maybe were superstitious. We talk about that. We're women scholars. The Beguines were scholarly. And the Native American women were serious. They maybe didn't have the books and scholarly books like we did, but they were also scholarly in their own way, in studying the plants and the herbs and knowing the animals and knowing about tracking. So our ancestors were all scholarly, and we're trying to be scholarly too, and we're trying to not be silly. Like, we have children at our ceremonies, and we have to make them understand that we're reaching back to our pre-Christian ancestors. But we also are not so silly that we don't realize they did some crazy stuff out of superstition, like praying extra hard all night to make sure that the winter's shorter. We know better, right? We know we're not going to shrink the winter, and we know we're not going to spread the nights, but they didn't. But this is all part of understanding who we are and getting to the core of, I think, what we're all here for is to understand basically what we're all here for.
I love it. I love it. And I would say one last thing that came to mind when you were talking about, you know, going into the Abbey and having people sitting in chairs and kind of looking at you versus sitting in a circle. I've had the opportunity to have some great discussions with a couple of Quakers through doing this podcast. And apparently that's a big part of the Quaker tradition. They did away with that sitting in pews and staring forward and organized things in more of a circle.
Oh, I love it. And see, that's I think that's all just very ancient wisdom.
Yes. Yes. Well, Sister Kate, I hope we can keep in touch. And like I said,
maybe, I don't know where you are exactly. Where are you based?
I'm in Orange County, California. So same state.
Oh, well, but... you know what? If you ever get up here, you can't, if you go on 99 up the state, you can't, we're not far off of 99, about an hour north of Fresno. So if you ever want to come visit our farm, just shoot me an email, okay?
Oh, perfect. I would absolutely love to do that. And I've got little ones. My kids are...
Yes, bring your little ones. Bring your little ones. We have little ones here every day because the people who work for us bring their children to work.
Nice.
So we're very children friendly. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. It was so nice talking to you, and I look forward to meeting you.
Likewise. Likewise. Thanks so much. And okay. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, bye.
My thanks to Sister Kate of Sisters of the Valley. Find out more about Sisters of the Valley at sistersofcbd.com. You can also check out Kate's blog at cannabiskateincalifornia.blogspot.ca. And I believe there's a BBC documentary in the works about the Sisters of the Valley, which I look forward to seeing. Please, if you like what we're doing with the No Prize From God podcast, leave a review in iTunes. It's very easy. You can do it right from your phone. The more 5-star ratings and reviews that we get, the higher the visibility for the podcast and the more people can discover it. You can find No Prize From God on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find me on Twitter at Ryan Downey, on Instagram at Superhero HQ. As always, you guys have been great, and I've been Ryan J. Downey.